This is a previously recorded episode.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
It's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch, and you're listening to the M Squared TechCast. It's our 15th program and our final one for 2015.
Amen on that. A little break next week. Matt's going to go up and hit with the Outlaws up there in Traverse City, right?
Or yeah,
no, that's the In-Laws. Same
yes.
thing, right? So,
well, it depends. It's going to be, in addition to family and alcohol, they've added a full moon to Christmas this
yeah,
year.
I heard
so
that.
I can hardly wait.
Oh, that'll be lots of fun. Yeah. The dysfunctional family drunk on a full moon. Go for it.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, the emergency rooms are going to be crowded across the fruited plain here, I think.
Yes.
But we got a jam-packed show for you, so let's get at it. Our guests today are going to be Jan Ness of Online Tech, Inc., a terrific data center and managed services provider out of Ann Arbor. Then we're going to hear from cybersecurity experts Dan Lohrman and Richard Steenen on the biggest cyber attacks of 2015 and what might be on the horizon for 2016. And then in our final segment at 3:45, Max Muncy, PR manager of the North American International Auto Show, which is coming up, is going to be talking to us about all of the cool technology involved in the auto show. And believe me, that is a tech toy playground now. It really is.
Well, for those who don't know, that's actually the Detroit Auto Show that grew up and 10 years ago went international, right, Max?
Absolutely.
89 we went international,
actually.
Is that
long already? No kidding. All right, cool. Well, let's get right to Jan. He's holding from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where you have a couple of data centers, and you were instrumental in what was happening. Well, you represented the industry side and the controversy or the issues over the tax breaks for the Switch data center coming out of Vegas. Now, I don't know if the governor has signed that yet. Do you know?
I have not heard that he has, but I haven't talked to their office yet. I'm pretty sure he will.
Okay. So essentially, the West Michigan delegation led by Birgit Close in the right place really wanted that folks to come in to take over that old 2 million square foot steelcase pyramid building. And they initially weren't going to include those tax breaks for the rest of the industry, but that's changed, right?
Yeah, so there's a burgeoning data center industry already in Michigan. We formed a Michigan Data Center Alliance with 9 companies, 38 data centers, about 1,000 employees, growing 12% a year. And so we're creating a lot of jobs already right here in Michigan.
How many? And you got some other ones in the works. I mean, you personally own, your company owns 3 in Michigan, or is it 4 in Michigan?
We have 4 in Michigan now, 2 just south of Ann Arbor at Pittsfield Township, 1 up in Flint Township near the airport, and then our newest one here in Michigan is in Westland, just on the west side of Detroit.
And these were some heavyweight facilities that you acquired from, I think GM was one of them, wasn't it?
Yeah, these were all basically, Fortune 500 company data centers that companies, across all industries are kind of getting out of this business and hiring companies like ours because the cybersecurity issues actually and the complexities are just so daunting, and they want to focus on their customers and their end users and less on all the gear and the cybersecurity issues. So we were successful in hooking up with General Motors EDS, with Sprint, with Thomson Reuters, and with FIS, all large companies, as they were shifting away from operating these things themselves. We would go in, acquire them, buy them, lease them, whatever, spend a bunch of money to turn them into multi-tenant cloud-capable data centers, and then service the likes of, Kelly Services and Two Men in a Truck to deliver their IT.
So, Jan, tell me, what are the taxes that have been cut for you as a data center operator? Or what are the taxes that prospectively, I guess since it hasn't been signed yet, will be cut for you?
Specifically, sales and use tax. There were three original bills, one for sales tax, the 6% sales tax we pay on gear, one for use tax, a third bill on the property tax, a personal property tax we all pay, which is pretty sizable. That money goes to locals and municipalities, and they decided that that should be decided by them, not the state, so that third bill did not make it through the Senate of the House. They punted that to next year.
So by saving this money, which sounds like a lot of money, is it going to allow you to develop another data center, hire some more people? What are you going to do with the extra cash?
Good question. The thing about this business model, which is why it takes it's a wonderful business model. It's a growing business model. It's in great demand. But the thing about it is you really need, diligent discipline in your financial acumen, because it's very capital intensive. So the faster we grow, the more cash we consume, right? And think about that for a minute until you hit a certain utilization of the data centers, and then you begin to throw some cash off. The thing is, the industry is growing so fast. Our challenge from our board is to grow twice as fast as the industry. And so any operating savings you get, like taxes or anything, is pretty quickly consumed in additional growth.
All right, Jan, so tell me how data centers create jobs. I mean, essentially, you're a hotel for other people's IT equipment, right? So how does that work? You create a relatively small number of jobs, in terms of employment at Online Tech Inc., but it's the clients who need people to run their stuff, right? That's where the real job creation comes in. That's the way I understand it anyway.
Well, not so much in our case. Where we see the growth, imagine a hotel, but where there's a butler, a cook, and a garment person in every single room, because the person there requires that level of service and capability. Maybe there's a nurse also, and all these other resources, so that you're much more self-contained, would be more like our model. There are like the pure data center guys. They can have a 200 or 300,000 square foot data center and operate it with a couple dozen people and fill it with gear. And you're right. I mean, it's basically you're managing a really, really large, super secure warehouse. It is the people that actually manage the gear where you get the jobs. What we have found is when companies have us manage their gear inside our data center, that's where we end up hiring the people, and that's where all our growth is right now. When companies don't hire us to manage the gear, they just want us to house it and keep it secure. We don't need to hire as many new people as we grow that side of our business. And our customers need to come here every so often, but we haven't seen just a ton of job growth from just the pure housing of servers.
All right. So how many employees does Online Tech have at this moment, and what kind of openings do you have? How many?
Let's see. I believe we are 68 people, and we have half a dozen openings in sales, networking, cloud architecture, deployments. I think those are the four positions. We're always looking. It's been very hard to find people.
Okay. Computer science majors, take note.
So Richard Steenen's in the studio, and he's a former creator, chief bottle washer for ResNet, one of the very first ISPs in the state. So how have data centers changed since your days, Richard? What, 20 years ago when you're involved in that?
Yeah, and soon after RustNet, I was looking at getting into the data center business and looked at one in Dearborn that was just beautiful, chillers and everything you would want. And the owners of it were divesting of their data centers because the theory was the computers were getting smaller, so there'd be less need for floor space. And obviously that didn't work out that way.
So what it is, John, is really everyone's – not everyone, but many people are outsourcing their IT centers to you guys. Would that sum it up?
Yeah, basically, this stuff is getting harder and harder to actually do, just even up to what's called sort of the operating system layer and keeping that secure. And people want to focus on actually building the app and helping the customer and, dealing with all the – whether it's upgrading patches on your servers, to backing them up, to a disaster recovery plan, to really cybersecurity is a big driver. It's just too much for a company to to be an expert in. I look at it like kind of like banking and power generation. So 100 years ago, people managed their own cash. I mean, my grandfather, when he died in the 80s, he still didn't trust banks. He wasn't going to put his cash in a bank. He had a shotgun, and he kept it at home, and he buried it. He literally buried it in various places that only he knew where.
Yeah, my wife had a grandmother like that. Wow. Okay.
Where do you live, Jan?
Yeah.
where does your grandfather live? You know. So.
And where's my metal detector?
Right. Right, yeah. Okay. But, you know, data's going to go through the same thing. Companies are kind of server huggers right now, or have been in the past 10 or 20 years, and they're rapidly now beginning to realize that there's just so much to this stuff. Other people should do this for us.
Cool. So, but what's the outlook for 2016 then? Pretty bright, I would imagine.
Yeah. So we're still seeing a lot of growth in our industry. The hardest part is staying up with that growth. And also, I mean, look, 65% of what we sell is cloud services. And 4 years ago, that term and that offering didn't even really exist in the industry, other than in some little testbed areas. And so what, if anything keeps us up at night, it's, okay, in 4 years from now, what are we going to be selling? I need to know that. I mean, you guys know this company was a dial-up ISP web hosting company when I bought it in July of 2003. And now we're, you know, 100,000 square feet of data center space and two cloud offerings, disaster recovery, a whole suite of stuff. That comes out of having to pay attention to what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years and pivoting when we need to. So we spend a lot of time on that.
Now, you guys are also the target of the bad guys that want access to that data, because that's the new gold out there, right?
It is. Data is worth money. Here's an interesting notion, guys. So look at the balance sheet of just about any company, and you'll see on there, down to a dollar, the furniture. You won't see anywhere on their balance sheet the value of their data, but the value of a Medicare of a medical record is about $200 to $500, depending if it's Medicare eligible or not, on the black market. So if you've got a couple million of those, you've got $1 billion worth of data.
Wow.
Now, if you show up tomorrow morning and all your furniture's gone, you probably can still operate to some degree. You know, it's maybe you're standing around or sitting or people working at home. But if you show up tomorrow and all your data's gone, you're completely out of business.
Yeah, there's a word for that, but we can't use it. So,
well, we can use it. We've chosen not to.
Yes, we don't use that word, but yes, we understand the concept. So
it's a snafu.
Yes. Oh, very good, Richard. I like that. Yeah. Yes. Well, good. So, I mean, does that keep you up at night worrying about whether you guys, because it's always measures and countermeasures. You do something, they do something, and it goes back and forth, right?
Well, yeah, we call it kind of like the spy versus spy thing, you know, where the white spy and then you got the black spy, and it's a war of algorithms, right? So we write algorithms or buy algorithms to protect us. They write them to hack into us. They also try a lot of social engineering that you're constantly focused on. But basically, I don't lose too much sleep about that because we invest so heavily in other people who are still up and watching that while we are all sleeping, and so our customers can sleep as well. But it's an absolute, whether it's Christmas morning, New Year's Eve, there is never a time where you turn the lights off and go home. There is always an intense group of people who are extremely focused on what's going on here.
Well, we're about out of time in this segment. Whoa, there we go. My mic was down. Go ahead and tell. I know you got some jobs available. Where do folks go on your website to find out about those jobs? We'll see if we can help you get some people to fill them.
That would be great. Appreciated. Greatly appreciated. Go to onlinetech.com. That's onlinetech.com. Company/company/careers, and you'll see them right there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jan Ness of Online Tech, Inc., headquartered in Ann Arbor with data centers in Ann Arbor, Flint, Westland, and Indianapolis. They would be a great choice for your data center needs. I guess that's a plug. Somebody ring the bell.
Ring the bell.
Okay. Thanks, Jan. Thanks for being with us here today.
There we go. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Merry Christmas.
Merry too.
All right, so I guess we're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back with Richard Steenen, who's in studio, and Dan Lorman, who's hanging on from Okemos or someplace out there in mid-state. But this is Mike Brennan.
And this is Matt Rausch.
And you're listening to M Squared TechCast.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast on the Podcast Detroit Network. And now it's time for a little cybersecurity update from our friends Dan Lorman, who is calling in from the Lansing area, and Richard Steenen, who is here in studio. Richard, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And welcome, Dan, too.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on again.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it over to you, Richard, because you're going to talk to us about the biggest data breaches, biggest security concerns of 2015. So let's start with a look back, and then we'll take a look forward.
Okay. But first, we have to interrupt our regularly scheduled podcast of 2016 breaches to talk about a newly announced breach that is rather serious.
Breaking news.
We just learned a couple days ago that Juniper Networks,
send your message now, press
Juniper
pound.
Is the,
to mark the message
we have
urgent,
apparently been
press
breached here.
So. To hear your message,
hang on here, We got the
record, press
what's
star.
Happening, Jessica?
It's Dan's voicemail.
Yeah, I'm trying to get out of it, but I'm on a call with him.
To send your message now, press pound.
Okay, let's take that down.
Okay, there yeah.
All right.
Keep talking?
Yes, go ahead.
All right, so Juniper Networks is the number two provider of routers and switches in the United States, probably number three worldwide if you account for Huawei, the Chinese version. And they just announced that somehow somebody got into their code base and modified it to put two different backdoors. One backdoor allows remote access. If you've got the password, you can log in remotely. And the other allows an attacker to intercept encrypted tunnels, so the VPN traffic that these things are used for all the time.
So the VPN is not so P.
Okay. Exactly. All right, not gotcha. So private. And this is extremely serious, right, that a vendor of security products, the NetScreen firewall and the Screen OS that runs that, has been compromised. So this is obviously
– Any ideas how?
Or? Well, it's indicative of a nation state attack because it's so sophisticated and goes so deep. And as a matter of fact, it reminds us of several vulnerabilities, backdoors in Cisco, Juniper, and Huawei gear that were introduced by the NSA. So very similar techniques and methodologies probably were used. There are over 27,000 machines, according to a company, Rapid7, that are on the internet right now that are vulnerable to this. I could tell you the password. You'd have to look it up because it's a lot of gibberish. The password was made to look like it was a standard command. So if people were doing logging of password attempts, they'd say, oh, somebody just typed in a command there and didn't realize that was actually a password. That password is published and widely available. So hackers right now are testing this out. These routers and firewalls are on some of the most critical networks in the world. So it's of extremely high concern.
Mm. Wow, that's a bad one.
Yipes. Okay, so that's the latest of 2015. Let's hit the other highlights of big breaches in 2015 and kind of what we've learned from them.
What sticks out in your mind, Dan?
Yeah, so I just interesting. I just did a blog on this, and I kind of call 2015 the year that data breaches became intimate. And I think everyone, when they hear that title, they think about, you know, the Ashley Madison breach. But really, it was not just – it was the OPM breach. The top five I had down is – you know, the Office of Personnel Management, which is the U.S. government, of course, 1 in 14 Americans had their background information breached, and I was one of those, sadly. If you had a clearance with the government, a contractor, that was a huge one that people are still, you know, getting their letters in the mail and recovering from. So the OPM breach, the Ashley Madison breach, which, of course, got a lot of headlines, you know, the whole issue of, you know, who was in that database and then the names being posted and that whole thing. Number three, I had the VTech, which is the Asian data breach, which, of course, is the toys. And that was really it, the intimate conversations between parents and the children, children playing with each other, actually not just, the data of, but, you know, literally the conversations were made available. And then number four I had, which I kind of looped some things together, hospital and healthcare data breaches. There were a number of big ones that were announced. Some people said just this whole year was the year of hospital and healthcare insurance data breaches. There's a number of them we could talk about. Excellus was one of the big ones. And then number five I had is the GPAC, you know, the cars being hacked. So those are my top five, Richard.
And those are huge. You know, I'm looking at a site that tries to track all of the breaches, and they claim over 290 million leaked records in 2015. That's essentially, you know, a record for every person in the United States over the age of 14, I would estimate. Though a lot of people are participating in each of these breaches. So somebody could have been at the government and had their top secret clearance information breached, as well as their Ashley Madison records, which actually did happen several times.
I read something over the weekend. I can't remember the source of it, but it said over 100 million Americans' personal information has now been captured by the bad guys, that which seemed like an astounding number to me. Does that seem like...
Yeah, it's completely true. Now, mind you, it's, you know, so they've got your credit card, right?
Yeah.
So you've got that notice already, and you've canceled your credit card, and you've got a new one. So sometimes it's not that debilitating, though it fuels the cybercrime industry, right? Because those guys are buying and selling those things and making money off of them. And of course, the banks are making everybody whole. So even if you're, you know, attacked and your money's taken out of your bank account, usually the bank gives it back to you. So you're in good shape there.
I know when my card got hacked, and Huntington issued me a new one with the chip in it. So,
right.
Supposedly,
yeah,
that's.
I think 2015 was different from previous years. It wasn't just about financial data. You know, it really was. When you have that, I mean, there were stories of people from the Ashley Madison breach committing suicide after that. I mean, so the impacts are hitting people. You know, children, you know, playing with toys, conversations, you know, hacking the Internet of Things. As we talk about the future, I know in the next segment, you know, where this is going. But I think that the impact, of course, financial data, you know, loss is huge. I'm not, you know, downplaying that. But I think in 2015, you know, when you hack a car and you hack brakes or you hack, you know, these, you know, there's so many other areas that are now in our lives where the virtual world and the cyber world are coming together. I think the impacts are even getting greater than they were before.
Yeah, that's the area that gets me interested. You know, there have been so many identity breaches that it becomes old news very, very quickly. But the newer level of attacks, either against devices like that or actually breaking into somebody's email account and releasing very debilitating data, as we saw originally in Sony, which of course was 2014. But this year we saw the White House get breached by Russian hackers, and supposedly President Obama's email was read and intercepted. The State Department and the Pentagon all had their email servers interrupted. So now we're going deeper. They don't necessarily search and then resell the information about who you are. They want to know what you're thinking and what you're communicating.
Hmm.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I know I would just add one other aspect of that is, you know, when you talk about medical records and, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, not just, again, financial data from hospitals and insurance companies, but people's, you know, history. And it makes you think, if they're hacking into your medical records, at what point in the future will it be they change things and actually can cause damage by changing the data and not just stealing the data?
Yeah, that's something to worry about in the Federal Reserve System. The banks, you know, basically that's just all held in a number account somewhere, and they just could change those. What about all these attacks on hotels? Why do you suppose that's happening? So I see, you know, three or four hotels this past year, Hilton Honors Points, Hyatt Gold Passport breaches. Do you think those are financial attacks?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a great point, Richard. And I think the challenge there too is, you know, what's available, and there's an opportunity aspect to it. You know, what is vulnerable, what's available. Like you just talked about with the Juniper hack. You know, now that it's available, you know, people are going to go after it. Is there a wider trend there? You know, about people's, you know, vacations or whatever. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I wonder if because a lot of times when there's credit points available, you know, very clever people could figure out how to accumulate those points and then cash them in. And I'm not sure. I haven't seen any evidence of that happening, but that could explain why they're targeting that as well.
So my Hilton Honors account has been compromised.
Yeah. So take the points out, cash them in, you know, buy the airplane tickets or something.
Okay.
Yep. And, of course, the Detroit Zoo's point-of-sale terminals were attacked this year. So if you want to look for a local.
Well, what I always want to know about these data breaches, though, is that somebody used my credit card number this past year to buy a big-screen TV in Houston, Texas, where I've never been. They were very it was an American Express card. They were very nice about it. They took it off of my bill. But what happens to the guy who buys the television? I mean, do they ever look for him? Do these people ever get busted? I mean, is there any consequence for
these things?
Actually,
they're mules. I first encountered that here in Michigan. We had a big card data breach thing go on, and the local police saw this suspicious activity. People were pulling up with big vans to one of the big retailers, and they would collect several widescreen TVs that were pre-ordered on the internet with credit cards, so paid for it, waiting for them, pick them up, put them in. And at the time, this was a day when I said, oh, there's no real organized crime in the cyber world. And a friend called up and says, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. These are Russian crime syndicates, have personnel on the street here in Michigan that go in, and these mules take the stolen goods, resell them on eBay, take the cash, launder it essentially, wire transfer it back to St. Petersburg.
Hmm. Okay.
That Putin is everywhere, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think the other thing that happens too, Richard, is I have read and talked to some people in different governments around the country, but the fraud aspect of if they have your number not getting detected, so going for $9.73 from Walmart type of thing, so where it can be repetitive and they can maybe fly under the radar, if you will. So I think that's another thing that's going out there that certainly happened in 2015. I know some states where there was UPS charges that were sent to different government entities that they were paying, and then they discovered it, and then they obviously went back and tried to resolve the situation. But when they were paying these bills for $200-$300 monthly that were fake, bills. So I mean, the wider fraud aspect of breaching credit cards, breaching financial systems, to maybe not go for the $1 million, go for $975 100 times.
Well, yeah, I've wondered about that too, because another time I had a credit card number get stolen. The way I found out about it is a whole bunch of 99-cent iTunes music purchases. And what I've been told is that they were just testing it to see if anyone was paying attention, more or less, and then they would try something big if I wasn't paying attention.
Well, yeah. You are just right on the cutting edge.
Oh,
you're the canary in the coal mine.
That's it. Well, same thing with my smartphone. I used it one time to buy some stuff at Walmart, and within a day – I had three or four charges on there for gamers from someplace in the world. So one of my apps on my phone, that clearly was harvesting my information. So I don't use my phone for anything financial.
Yeah, let me ask you about that too. Is the security of smartphones? I mean, is everybody walking around with malware in their smartphones? Pretty much, seems like it.
Just about every app, especially an Android app, is malware of some sort. Right, it's stealing your location data so they can resell it. But I'm not worried about smartphones, never have been, and I don't think I ever will be.
Because?
Because they're not Windows PCs. So they're not – you can't get into the OS of an operating system other than one recent breach and jump from one to the other. So you can't download a virus that gets on the phone and SMSs itself to another phone, and pretty soon the virus spreads everywhere. They are really containerized. It's very nice.
And that's
I would agree with that. Yeah, the apps are unique, and you're not going to jump across the app discussion.
Okay, so and that's what happened in the early days of computer viruses, back in the early uh-ohs or zeros or whatever you want to call the first decade of this century, is we had people that would click on something and it would spread it to an entire network.
Yep.
So
we can't let the segment pass without talking about the cyber war going on between ISIS and Anonymous. So now we've got two extremist hacker groups, both using the same capabilities that the internet and social media gives them to recruit and find experts to do bad stuff, but they're fighting each other.
Absolutely, and I was actually going to mention it. I'll come up with a little preview of the next segment, but, you know, John McAfee's come out and predicting there will be, you know, I know your book, Richard, there will be a cyber war, or he's saying there will be a cyber war with ISIS in 2016, and we may actually lose. It's you know, pretty bold predictions, and giving John McAfee some airtime here, but a lot of articles out there about that, and just the fact that our enemies are, you know, fairly sophisticated in some of the techniques they're using to both to recruit and possibly even attack Western nations.
I think what we're going to do is just keep rolling rather than take a break. So whenever you can keep going on what happened this year or move into next year, however you want to play it, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, let's take it from there. Dan, what do you think the likelihood of that sort of cyber terrorists doing any damage to us in 2016 is?
I think it's, we've been talking for years. I mean, we're doing the 20 prediction for this year, 2015, and there were a lot of people who predicted, I think 2 years ago, we were going to have a cyber 9/11 or a cyber Pearl Harbor, that the grid's going to go down, you're going to bring down the grid. Of course, that book just came out.
Lights Out by Ted Koppel.
Exactly. You know, getting a lot of airtime, getting a lot of thanks for, mentioning that. So, yeah, and I think that it's certainly, a possibility. I mean, I don't know if I had to put a percentage on it, what I think. I'd love to hear your view. But, I mean, I'd say, 1 in 10, could it happen? Absolutely. I think the capability is there. Whether it will happen this year, I mean, it's like predicting, a blizzard. It's a little bit hard to know exactly. Maybe the day before it's going to hit, but, months ahead of time, when something's going to hit. It is interesting, I find, though, if you think about Homeland Security, the last three Homeland Security secretaries have all said we're going to have a major, critical infrastructure event in America, from Janet Napolitano. It really going back a ways, they've been predicting this. So, will it be 2016? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that there certainly could be a major event like that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly have learned my lesson in not to predict future disasters because, of course, you're happy when they don't happen. But everyone in the technology space agrees that it'd be fairly easy to do. And as a matter of fact, most people scratch their heads and wonder why it hasn't happened if people out there hate the United States so much or any other Western country. But I have seen some disturbing signals. And one is the number of machines that are in control systems that are connected to the internet are well mapped, so they're there, and their vulnerabilities are just rampant in the control systems that are used to turn on power and lights and control turbines at a gas generation plant. And in the past year, we've seen two separate families of malware that have spread amongst those systems that evidently are just there to map them out and do the reconnaissance. And reconnaissance is, of course, the first step before attacks. And that malware is of a family that can be attributed to Russian hackers. So now it seems like the tell signals are leading up to some sort of attack to demonstrate their capability or do something debilitating.
Yeah, I think there were some studies in 2015. Trend Micro did one. I know there was one that came. A number of different major, think tank organizations that the attacks against critical infrastructure, like you said, looking at people testing things out, trying to get in, destroy data, and that kind of thing. The number of attacks have increased, and they continue to increase. So I do think it certainly will happen at some point, whether it happens in 2016 or not. Not sure. I mean, some of the other predictions I've seen out there that I certainly, believe in, kind of turning the corner there, would be Internet of Things. As that grows, I mean, we're seeing obviously all the talk about robots and cars that drive themselves, new artificial intelligence, and then yet a lot of these new IoT devices, even Christmas presents that are coming out, are really not secure. They're being rolled out in a way that is not, it's just not secure. They can be hacked, different devices, smart homes, smart kitchens, even people talk about smart, roads, and of course we've seen things like road signs being hacked and that kind of thing. But it makes you wonder, you know, the IoT, as more and more devices are connected to the internet, what IoT hacks are going to make the headlines a year from now? I mean, could there be ransomware tied to that? Could there be Internet of Things, you know, what other devices or, you know, I mean, who knows? They, you know, something radical like, you know, take over amusement park or something. I don't know. I mean, something that gets the headlines. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I wanted to point out. I've been saying for years now that the Internet of Things should be called the Internet of Things that can be hacked. And I've been sort of suspicious about this for a long time. You know, somebody turning off your refrigerator when you're on vacation, so you come home to a house full of rotted food, or worse yet, turning on your oven or your broiler and all your burners on your stove full blast, and maybe setting your house on fire. You know, something like that. I mean, the first disgruntled spouse to do that. It's just what I'm waiting for.
Oh, you know, yeah. I hadn't thought of that angle. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, wasn't the Target attack, didn't they come in through a vendor Coke machine or something or other?
No. So the Target was just they had given access to a vendor of their ventilation systems.
I thought it was an HVAC contractor.
I wasn't sure. I knew something kind of that you don't think about.
But everything's on the same network.
Right.
So that was the issue. Exactly. So I've got a prediction for more of the enterprise security that we deal with every day, Dan, in that I've watched as the industry itself is responding to all these sophisticated attacks, so-called APTs, and what they're attempting to do is shorten the time that they have to react. So, you know, today I think the Verizon data breach says the average dwell time for an attacker is something over 200 days. Hmm. So if you do a little bit of security, you can get that down to a couple days, right? So you just look at your logs and try and figure out what's going on. And then there's a whole slew of new vendors coming out that are trying to get it down to hours or minutes, which is all well and good. We have not seen what I believe the future of these types of attacks, though I think we will see it in 2016, and that's an autonomous attack. So an autonomous attack is all pre-programmed. The attacker hits go or somehow, you know, gets the malware onto a network through a USB token or something, and the malware moves laterally, finds what it wants, steals it or breaks it, and then leaves. And you might have seconds to respond to that. Now, I did say we hadn't seen it, but we have. It's called Stuxnet. So that Stuxnet is now going on 8 years old.
Is it that long now?
So the attackers know what they have to do, right? It's all been spelled out for them. But they just haven't had to because there's so many targets that aren't very well protected.
Yeah, well, that's certainly very likely. I mean, I just had another, you know, I've read a number of different predictions. I would throw in another prediction. I see, you know, when will we see, kind of what you just implied about, you know, burn down the kitchen, but when will you see murder committed via the internet? I mean, medical devices, changing data, some big headline. I mean, whether it happens in 16 or 17, I don't know, but I could easily predict that there's going to be some data change. Somehow somebody's going to do something that's going to be viewed as, you know, murder by, you know, hack kind of thing.
So, yeah, so turn the Wi-Fi off on the insulin pump or the pacemaker, right? You just don't
was part of a movie plot that a vice president in the movie, he was wearing a pacemaker, and they got the code for the pacemaker and turned the pacemaker off and his heart stopped.
Yep.
So I can't remember the name of the movie, but I remember that was the plot.
Or another movie, Hackers or something, they modified a health report for a powerful senator or something.
It's been in the movies, but I mean, we haven't seen, you know, front page Washington Post, you know, somebody important, some CEO from some corporation or something. I mean, I just see that happening in the next few years.
What I wanted to ask both Dan and Richard is if something like that happens, will we even know? Will we even be told about it?
Somebody will figure it out.
What do we do to improve the transparency of reporting of data breaches and sort of the intelligence gathering and how that all works and you know, so how we can sort of share data better without maybe necessarily airing everybody's dirty laundry? But the information's got to be shared for us to put our brains together and develop ways to fight this stuff, right?
Yeah, the first suspicion on the minds of any security person is hacker. So if something happens like that, mysterious car crash, you remember when Michael Hastings reporter for BuzzFeed or something, I think, had a very strange incident where his car accelerated very fast and it supposedly blew up before it hit a tree. First suspicion on everybody's part was, oh, it was hacked by his adversaries. Turned out not to be the case.
Hmm.
Well, that's the tricky part about covering security, cybersecurity, is when something happens, the people that get hacked or whatever, they don't want to talk about it. And when the vendors have the technology to block it, they don't want to talk about it. So, I mean, it's like you just don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and there's not enough good investigative reporting in the technology area altogether, right? So, at least in my experience, it's been taken over by the trade press, and they don't want to criticize the vendors because they're the advertisers.
Right.
And they don't want to dig. It takes too much time when you can just create a listicle of something exciting to get people to get you those clicks.
Yes.
So, Richard, what do you think the impact, assuming that President Obama signs the cyber legislation that's about, probably going to hit his desk here before the end of the year, how do you see that, going back to Matt's question about how do you see that impacting the sharing of data and the landscape in 2016, as a direct result of that legislation change?
Well, certainly the NSA and FBI will have to hire fewer attorneys, and I don't think it'll have any impact whatsoever on slowing down attacks. I think it's just more of a greasing the skids for the kind of network that DHS in particular wants to build.
I would agree. I think the overall impact is going to be relatively small. Yeah, maybe it's moving around the chairs in the room of who's in charge of what, and maybe it's better, maybe it's not. But, I think the overall impact on the direction we're heading as an industry, I'm not sure that it's going to make a huge difference.
That said, DHS is, finally gearing up here to actually do some good information sharing. Andy Osmond now has his team that's sucking data out of most agencies. And then making it palatable or consumable by anyone who wants it, for that matter, which might impact the threat intelligence private vendors a little bit. Andy says, go on and do something that enriches that data somehow. But we're going to see some good results, I think. I think the federal government overall is actually going to figure out how to protect itself.
We've got about a minute left, guys. So any other things you want to hit about what should folks do to protect themselves? I mean, just the average consumer, let alone the businesses.
I mean, I think the number one thing is just do your homework. I mean, know what you're getting into, the Consumer Reports for cyber. But, when you buy something, especially an IoT device, a watch, whatever you're getting, make sure you know what you're buying and enable and configure the maximum security that you're able to configure on the device. So many people will talk about, security problems, and a lot of it is, even in enterprises as well, this lack of poor policy or implementation of the features that are available. So making sure you know what you've got and what you're doing, and what consumers the same way. Use what you're already able to use. That'd be my first thing.
Take us out, Richard.
My advice is trust no one.
So. Especially if they're over 30, right?
On that cheery note, it's time for our quick little break here. So this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast. We'll be right back with news about technology of the North American International Auto Show.
Hey, it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you're on M Squared TechCast with Max Muncy, who is the PR manager for, well, we're called the North American International Auto Show, and you're all going, what? Well, that's the Detroit Auto Show, which starts, well, for us, for the press, starts on the 12th.
January 11th is 11th. The first press day. 11th and 12th okay. kick things off.
So okay.
T-minus 20 days if you're counting.
All right. And the public show dates are?
16th through the 24th.
Okay. And we're here to have you. I mean, this is a tech show, so we wanted to ask you about some of the high-tech touches at this year's auto show. For one thing, one of the booths this year is the sort of number one tech news website, CNET. They're going to be live at the auto show, right?
Yeah, CNET's been a huge partner for us this year. So they came to the table, and in a big way, they're going to have actually display out on the main show floor this year. So they're going to be live streaming all the press conferences, conducting executive interviews from the booth.
Wow.
They're rolling out a new brand for them. So they're going to roll out the Roadshow, which is going to be a separate automotive entity for them. So they're looking to drum up a lot of awareness on the new platform. And so we're really excited to have them to the table. And they really help to elevate a lot of the technology that's being unveiled at the show too.
Seems like a number of years ago, Microsoft played that role, didn't they, if I recall?
They did a long time ago. Microsoft was a big partner to the show, and they've moved on now. And CNET came, and CNET's just one of the few big media partners that have come to the show this year. So we're looking forward to seeing how that really shakes out.
And who are the others? If folks want to see what's going on, because the press preview days – this will be my 20th year. It's been fun. I really look forward to it every year because we get pampered, of course. But there's only like 4,000 or 5,000 of us versus when you go to the regular show, my God, there must be 20,000 people in that hall, right?
We pack in about 100,000 people a day over the course of public show. But to your point, so if you can't attend press preview, encourage you to either look at CNET's live coverage. Autoblog will also be live streaming everything. They're our official live webcast sponsor, and Rob Report as well too. So between those three media partners, they really cover the whole automotive community from technology to luxury to just down and dirty on the vehicles.
And yeah. give our plug at WJR. I think Paul W. also doesn't he do a show from there?
Paul W. will live stream as well,
too.
So you
got to hit the bell. That's one of our
Shameless plug bell.
I'm on the bell.
Okay.
So that will be really big this year, too. So I think, right, we view our show, we're an international media show. So bringing a lot of these partners to the table help elevate the brand and the automakers' messages coming out of the two press days. But I should say that we're talking a lot about technology, but the show is also going really old school this year. So we partnered with LeMay Car Museum out in Tacoma, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And actually starting on December 27th, we're going to drive three classic cars, a 66 Ford Mustang, 61 Chrysler 300G, and a 57 Chevy Nomad, all the way from the museum over about 2,400 miles, and they'll end up in Detroit just before the auto show. So we're also going old school with this, too.
Boy,
so
it looks like you're going to luck out on the weather this year, huh? It's an El Nino year, so
we got to knock on wood here because they're going the northern route to get here. So Michelin signed on, though, as our tire sponsor, so we'll at least have some really nice.
So they're going to go on 90?
They are. They're coming all the way up through the mountains.
Nasty weather, that gets real nasty up there.
We will have some new technology. So we'll have GoPros strapped to the vehicles and a bunch of stuff, and visit the site and watch, you know, as these cars make their journey here to Detroit. So.
I was going to say, on the other hand, if you take I-90, you could pretty much sleep through eastern South Dakota and Minnesota because there's nothing to see.
Yeah.
So
you
absolutely
shoot a cannon
nothing.
Down the
Unfortunately,
street
I don't think they can set the cruise control on these cars.
Well, no cruise.
Your foot's going to go
numb. Put a brick on the accelerator or something. Right?
So, that'd be perfect.
So what's Rob Report doing for you? That's the sort of the magazine for Thurston Howell III types, right?
So they're an ultra-luxury publication that's coming to the table. So in two functions. One, they're a big sponsor of our ultra-luxury event, The Gallery, that kicks off the show that Saturday, January 9th at MGM Grand. So in MGM's Grand Ballroom, we'll have just over $8 million worth of vehicles on display there.
Wow.
So Ferrari, Rolls-Royce, Aston Martin.
Is that part of our press pass? Or?
It is, yes.
Oh, gosh,
you can come.
Attend that. Yeah.
And so they're a sponsor of that. And then also then, so Rob Report will have a display out on the main show floor, and they're going to bring over about 10 vehicles from our gallery event that will be on display at the show mixed in with a couple high-end antique classic cars as well, too. So they're going to add something really interesting to the show that we haven't had in the past.
So remembering that this program is audio only, we don't have any visual aids here, but the auto show floor is changing this year. Talk a little bit about that, if you would. People are moving around.
I'm looking at a map. Let me hold it up in front of the microphone.
Here. Oh, yeah. So, you can see it now, folks? Yeah, okay, great.
No, the show floor has gone through a remarkable transformation. Almost 5 years in the making to get it to where it is today, and I joked with you guys earlier, but we're on version 167 of the floor plan for this year. So 70% the show floor is brand new this year. And in addition to a layout change, you're going to see all new exhibits from those automakers that have moved around. And as part of the new exhibit builds, right, we all know they're packing tons of technology and engaging things to get the consumers ramped up about their brand. So that will be really exciting to see. Been down in Cobo now almost every other day, and watching these things come together is remarkable. We've got double-deckers back and escalators.
Oh, the double-deckers are back?
Double-deckers
all
are
right.
back. So
yeah.
One automaker to be named putting an escalator into their double-decker. So we'll have to wait and see. But on the technology side, then, with the new show floor, IBM is our technology partner that we've announced this year. So IBM is building us an interactive wayfinding app for the show floor. So we've installed 30 beacons around the floor, and kind of like a Pac-Man effect, right? You'll load the app up and you'll see 30 red dots out on the show floor. As you walk around and pass each beacon, the dot will turn from red to green, indicating that you've obviously gone through this exhibit. The goal then is at the end of completing the 30 beacons, you'll get a push notification on the phone that says, congratulations, you've now seen the entire North American International Auto Show. And then it's going to prompt you to enter for a raffle, and we're going to be giving away a bunch of auto show swag to attendees for the show.
It should be $500 off the car of your choice if you do all 30, right? That'd be a good one.
Well, the show's come a long way since I was the first one to drop an ISDN line into Cobo Hall and connect it to the internet back in 93.
Ooh, what was that used for then? Was it just...
So I was demonstrating RustNet, and I had a silicon graphics machine there, and there were 10 other internet companies. This was an industrial show, and they all had to come over to show people what the internet was.
Huh. Oh, that's amazing.
Well, so, the mobile apps, you got new mobile apps too, or is that what you just described?
That's the new wayfinding app.
Okay.
WDAV Channel 4 is our official auto show app that has a bunch of content on there and photos and our social media feeds. The IBM app is really the wayfinding tool to then help people navigate. So year one, we're going to go with this Pac-Man effect. But then in future years, the beacons allow us the opportunity to start engaging with consumers more, give them push notifications. We could put a beacon, let's say, in front of the Ford GT. So if you're standing in front of there for over, let's say, 10 seconds, it can send you a push notification. Do you want to download photos of the car, video, more information? So we're going to wait to roll that out. We do know some automakers are using their own beacon technology as well, and I think largely that will be the role for that, as they want to really engage with the consumer standing in front of the vehicles.
You could have an order book, press button for salesman or something, and they'll come to you, right?
You could enter your zip code right in there, and it could locate the nearest dealership to your area. I mean, it's really limitless what we can do with these beacons starting now. So,
So I would imagine the exhibits themselves have gone pretty high tech too. A lot of interactive touches. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, right. That's the biggest thing, right? The consumers come down to engage with the brands. One of the automakers, we had the opportunity to put on some 3D goggles and go through like a virtual tour of their new exhibit build. You're going to have to wait and see who it is, but they joked around and said they have so many LED screens in their exhibit, they had to talk to Cobo to see if it was actually going to shut down the power when this thing fired up. They were going to look at bringing in a generator outside just to run this exhibit. So I think that's the biggest thing, right? I mean, unique to our show, these exhibits take 12 weeks to build out. We start literally in early October laying the groundwork. So,
yeah, I know I've been to events at Cobo, and I'll stick my head in there, and like you say, in October, and they're already starting. And you go, really?
Yeah, one of the only shows to be really able to say that, which we're quite proud of. Other shows take about 2 weeks to set up. At Cobo, it takes 2 weeks alone to put in our overhead lighting for the exhibits, which by the time you come down there, you really never see the lighting. So it's amazing on the back end what goes into these.
Yeah, that's one of the favorite auto show tours I ever took was I got to the backstage tour where you go behind the exhibits. And it's really like being in the back of a you know, major television show or something, you know, where they have sets that are going to be there for you know, maybe years if the show's successful. They're that carefully constructed and that, you know, realistically wired. And this thing is 20 days and then that's it. You know, it's torn down at that point. That's what's incredible
about
it. It's
done. Then it gets boxed up and put in a warehouse and gets ready for the next year. But this year with all the new exhibit builds, we got an estimate from some of the automakers. It looks like we'll have about $200 million of investment put into just the new exhibits this year at the show.
Okay. What sort of economic impact does the show have on, well, I guess, downtown Detroit? Right? It's got to be phenomenal, right?
So last year, we were right around $400 million of economic impact to southeastern Michigan. I actually just got a report this morning from our firm that tracks that for us, and they're anticipating to be about $430 million this
wow,
year.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Does that app help with parking? I know that's always an issue for this show because you get essentially parking. You get 100,000 people a day going through there, right, during the public show. So
parking is a little tight this year. You know, certainly the city has gone through quite a rebirth and revitalization. A lot more people are working downtown and living downtown, and monthly parkers alone, I know, are maxing out the available parking. So I put out a PSA the other day in Crane's Detroit Business, but if you have a parking garage downtown, we would love to talk to you.
Are you going to do a shuttle service? I mean,
we will do shuttles from all the major hotels, and we're looking at some opportunity to do some shuttle service as well at some of the bigger venues downtown and bring people down to the show too.
Yeah, because again, you don't know what – we've been in all sorts of weather for that show. It could be 20 below or it could be 50 degrees, right?
It's really a roll of the dice, but I'm praying really hard that we continue this weather into January here. So
I'm looking at the – now, this is for us, for the press. I'm sorry, folks, but you can watch. There's like 36 events, but how many of these are actually new vehicle introductions, and some of them are just events, right?
So right now we're trending to have over 40 vehicle reveals at the show this year, and about 90% of those are going to be worldwide. So those are the ones that, you know, the sheet comes off and nobody's ever seen them before. Hopefully, you know, credit to what Ford did last year with the GT that was developed down in, I believe, almost like a janitor closet and nobody knew about it. So you know, the automakers really tend to pull out all the stops at our show and bring the biggest vehicles to. So looking forward to January and see what's going to roll out on the
stage. And as our buddy Bill Gates said many years ago, that cars would be just computers on four wheels. That's really
just
the case.
Just
now,
another point on the network, yes. I believe, is the phrase they used. Yeah, and everybody laughed at him, and it's really happened.
And as you know, talk about how the show's evolved a bit. So we launched a brand new website this year that people can go to. It's naias.com. And it was mobile-friendly design this year, so we built it after we looked at the traffic. It's definitely smartphone first. It pulls in all our social media feeds, video, photos, and content. So it's a great resource for people wanting to learn more leading up to the show.
All right, Max, we got about a minute left, so let's go back over. Now, for us, you know, it's one thing, but for the rest of the 850,000 folks that come there, give them some details on how they're going to get around, where they should park, anything like that, what you can tell them.
I think our website's the best resource to get all that information. We identify the parking garages, times. You can purchase your tickets right online. But, yeah, Saturday, January 16th at 9 a.m., the doors open to the public, and then we'll run all the way to Sunday, January 24th.
And it's how much to get in?
It's $13 for a ticket to get
that's
in.
That's for an adult?
It
kids
is.
Get in free? Or
10 and under get in free.
Perfect.
So what site's got all the good information. We'll be running a military day again. So free tickets to our service members as well. So it's really looking to be a big, big show this year, from the exhibits to the technology to the cars. Really looking forward to see what happens.
One more time, give us that website address.
It is naias.com.
And this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Roush, and this has been the M Squared TechCast. I want to thank our guests today, Max Muncy from the Detroit Auto Dealers Association, which runs the Detroit Auto Show, cybersecurity experts Dan Lorman and Richard Steenan, and online techs Jan Ness. We're going to be taking the week off next week, so if you missed any part of this show, you can hear it again next Monday.
We're
going to
recycle it next Monday, so you get Richard gets double duty on his show. So,
but we will be back on Monday, January 4th, with the lovely and multi-talented Jessica, our engineer, thank you so much for your work with us.
Some days.
Some days. Also on the 4th, I might add, the Diva Tech Talk ladies are coming back.
Oh, that'll be fun. All right, they're a fun bunch.
They are, especially if we get a couple beers in them, right?
Okay, so. Well, that is well, eventually there will be afternoon drinking in the show. It hasn't happened yet, but you know, I have faith. We'll get there eventually.
All right. Well, again, Merry Christmas to all,
and to all a good night. This is Matt Rausch
and Mike Brennan,
and you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.
This is a previously recorded episode.